with Curtis Lewa.
Two young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Lewa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Lewa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Lewa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Lewa, legendary New Yorker.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Lewa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Seven minutes after the hour of 5, it's yours truly, Curtis Lewa, taking you home on the drive home at 5. And earlier today, during Curtis and Kubi, that's right, Kubi, whose mommy is a commie, was out again. And his son, Stu, was Larry Menti. And he was sitting in the very same seat that Anthony Weiner sat when substituting for Ron before all the walls came tumbling down on him. And that final wall came tumbling down today when he went into federal court, threw himself at the mercy of a federal judge, pled guilty to underage sexting, and faces possible prison time in either camp fed or wearing a bracelet at home. But I remember for the 3 days that Anthony Weiner, the Weiner, substituted for Ron, he did a very good job. He was very affable, very cordial. Listen to what the instructions were. But I remember telling our program director, Craig Schwab, the guy has an insatiable desire to constantly text and what I believe was sexting. And it was nonstop. The guy just could not control himself. And it proved to be his demise. On the line right now, though, to discuss the meteoric rise of Anthony Weiner, who could have been mayor of the city of New York, and how he has exploded into a million pieces, is Errol Lewis, host of The Road to City Hall on New York One. Thanks for joining us again, Errol, here on the Drive Home at 5.
Glad to join you.
Now, you certainly had Anthony Weiner sitting there for you on your weekly segment of The Wise Guys. He's written columns for the New York Daily News, and this was all after he was sort of resurrected and revived. What do you remember about those days when you'd be having a discussion with him?
Well, the Wise Guys is intended to shed perspective and give some insight into the political scene from the point of view of people who have run and who have served in office. And so Ed Koch was one of our Wise Guys, one of the originals. Senator D'Amato is one of our New York One Wise Guys. And when an opening at the table was there, we thought about it, and then we said, you know what? A younger perspective, a guy who certainly knows the business, involuntarily retired, at least at the time, from politics. And so we invited Anthony Weiner, and he brought something every week. You know, I mean, most importantly, he'd bring his son by the studio. So we were all big fans of his son, Jordan, a very young kid. Weiner knows the business. I mean, he's a first-rate strategist. As far as understanding what you can do and what you can't do, he knows a lot of people. He knows a lot of players that he'd been in the game for really his whole adult life at that point. Once upon a time, he was the youngest member of the city council. I think he was elected at age 23. So he had a decent perspective that was really helpful. And I think he connected with a lot of our viewers, despite him being a controversial figure.
So when he wasn't sitting with you in the panel discussion, the Wise Guys, mm-hmm. and he was off camera, off mic, how did he appear to be to you, just as a normal, average, everyday human being?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the only difference between on camera and off camera, and, you know, it's not like I was a close personal friend. I mean, I was friendly with him, friendly with his wife. You know, there might be a little more profanity, but otherwise the discussion and the analysis was the same. I mean, he just loved this game. There are a handful of people, you're one of them, Curtis, you know, where you can just talk about anything. You can bring up a district leader race in the Bronx from 10 years ago, and there's some people who remember that stuff, and they catalog it, and they understand it, and they see how all of the pieces fit together and they develop theories about what might happen next. You know, that there's a part of it that's a game, not in a playful sense, but in a sort of a strategic sense. He was one of those kind of people. There are not that many of them, frankly, in New York, who are so dedicated to this stuff, who understand it so deeply that you can really kind of go different places and speculate about what's possible and what's not possible. Because you got to understand who gets elected and who doesn't. It's not just a sort of a trivia game about who wins and who loses. Depending on who wins and loses, as we now know, looking at Washington, certain policies move forward and certain policies die. So it's in the end, it's a pretty serious business. And he was both serious about it, but also, I think, had the right kind of playful, almost cynical attitude about some of it.
Now, Errol Lewis, I want to take you back to the day that I saw the resurrection politically of Anthony Weiner, candidate for mayor. It was Flag Day, June 14th, 4 years ago. He had just emerged in a heated pack of about 6, 7, 8 candidates running for the Democratic primary, since it was an open election for the mayoralty. And Bill de Blasio was back in the pack with the rest. And I remember he gave a speech in the Forest Hills Gardens, not far from where he still shared that apartment with Huma on Austin Street. And the press was there. They couldn't believe he was jumping into the race. He gave an unbelievably great speech. He was oblivious to all of their concerns about him jumping in. And remember, he skyrocketed right to the lead.
Oh, sure. Yeah, when he jumped into the race, I think he was in second place. I mean, after resigning from Congress in disgrace, a few years later, he decides to come back. He's got several million dollars in his campaign account. It was kind of burning a hole in his pocket. He either had to use it or lose it at that point. He picked me and our show as his comeback vehicle, or at least in part. It was the first televised interview he'd done. It was pretty much where he announced that he was going to be running again. We sat down, and, you know, it was bittersweet, you know, even at the time, because he knew he was going to turn the race upside down. He knew he was going to rocket to the lead. And yet, in that same interview, Curtis, I asked him, I said, look, we know about all of the cases, right? I mean, we heard about the cases that you were involved in where you were sexting with women that you'd never met, and that's why you resigned from Congress. Do we now know the full extent of it? And I expected him to just say yes. But he didn't say yes. He gave this meandering kind of semi-explanation that went on for 2 minutes, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, this isn't over. You know, and it was like finding out there's a ticking time bomb. And eventually, of course, it did explode.
Well, after he went into court today and he awaits sentencing in September on his copping a plea to the underage sexting charge, his wife, Huma Abedin, filed in Manhattan court for divorce. What did you make of that political relationship? Because you've seen many political relationships in your time.
Well, I don't think this was, strictly speaking, political, because, frankly, it didn't do very much for either of them politically. You know, I mean, it's one thing if he had become mayor, I suppose. There's some advantage to that. But, you know, she didn't help him politically in any realistic sense. He certainly didn't do her any favors politically. And, you know, even before the scandal, frankly, it wasn't really of all that much help to her in the politics that she was practicing, which were the politics of, you know, sort of proximity to Hillary Clinton. So I'm not sure I would call them a political power couple. I mean, they both were in politics. They both were rising to the top of their respective fields. The synergy was never really there. There was never it wasn't like it was a package deal. In fact, frankly, until he was in the midst of scandal, I think that might have been the first time that she ever even materialized on the campaign trail with him. She wasn't that kind of a spouse. She had her own stuff going on. She was visiting over 100 countries with the Secretary of State as her chief of staff. She was doing other stuff. And by the same token, you didn't see him in the middle of Clinton world. He was certainly wired into it in a very direct way at the highest levels. But from early on, I think the standing order was that he was to keep his mouth shut about what he knew, about what would or would not happen. And it was very rare to get any insight from him, even off camera, about what was likely to happen.
Do appreciate your input. That's Errol Lewis. He's host of The Road to City Hall. It's a Spectrum project. It used to be Time Warner. It's on New York One. We were talking about Anthony Weiner when he used to be on the Wise Guy segment. That's on Tuesday nights. I would appear with Errol Lewis, as I do with my TV partner, Hurston Burrow, every Wednesday night. And I got to tell you, this guy, Anthony Weiner, even after resigning from Congress, when jumping back into the Democratic primary back on Flag Day, June 14th of 4 years ago, could have won and become mayor of the city of New York if he hadn't been sexting and texting his way into Camp Fed.
Imus in the morning.
So far, so good.
And the drive at 5.
There are so many ways to do it.
On air, online, on the app.
That's unbelievable.
77 WABC.
By 25, a whole cottage industry has developed. I'll call it Friends of the Sacked FBI Director James Comey. As we continue here on The Drive Home at 5, because they keep emerging as sources for stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post and on PBS TV. On the line to discuss that is Jeffrey Lord, CNN political commentator. You oftentimes can see him in the battle of what I call the Hollywood Squares. He's the lone defender of Trump, surrounded by Clintonistas. And he joins us again from your home outside of the state capitol in Harrisburg, Jeff.
Hello, that is correct, Curtis. Absolutely here on a nice, hot, sunny day.
Now, by the way, Jeffrey, because that is the heartland of America, and it was the area that went for Trump and flipped the script on Clinton, per the president's visit to Saudi Arabia, if you were to go to your local steakhouse, would you be ordering a steak with Heinz 57 ketchup on the side like the president has ordered to be part of his halal meal in Saudi Arabia with the sheikhs?
Absolutely. Bring America to Saudi Arabia. I'm all for it.
Oh, wow. And you remember Heinz out of Pittsburgh, had he not died in that helicopter.
I have to tell you, Curtis, one of my early bosses in life was United States Senator John Heinz, the heir to the Heinz ketchup fortune, who sadly died in a tragic plane crash while he was in the Senate a few years after I had gone on to the White House. He was quite the guy, and as a matter of fact, taught me the proper way to use a ketchup bottle.
Oh, you mean you didn't pound it on the bottom?
No, you don't pound it on the bottom. You hold it upside down, and you take two fingers, and you tap it on the neck.
Oh.
How about that?
Oh, does that also work for Hunch ketchup?
I don't know. He didn't say.
But anyway, to the friends of James Comey, I never knew he had so many friends. We're learning each and every day of these friends as they emerge as hidden sources for articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post. But one of them emerged last night on PBS TV to describe that moment in the Oval Office when James Comey, FBI director then, was on one side of the room and the President Trump was on the other side with a lot of dignitaries. How it was that James Comey was trying to hide in the drapes.
He really wanted to kind of blend in and not be singled out. And he's 6'8". So it's when you're
kind of tough to do
when
that.
You're 6'8", it's really hard to blend in. He's wearing, if you watch the video of it, he's wearing a blue blazer. And he stands in the part of the room that is as far from Trump as it is physically possible to be, and also against blue drapes that are the same color as his...
He chose that spot?
He chose that spot because it was, like almost like a chameleon, camouflaged against the wall.
Like a praying mantis, right?
Good analogy, Curtis. I heard this story, and I just found it astonishing. And I have to tell you, an amusing sidebar to this, my editor at the American Spectator, Bob Tyrrell, wrote a satirical piece yesterday, the day before, in which he said that at a conference in the White House, the president excused himself to take a phone call from Melania and left Comey alone, and he blew his nose on the curtains, and this was revealed in a White House camera, and there's a big scandal that's about to come out. About 24 hours after that, and this was satire, out pops this story that says he really was trying to hide in the curtains.
Now,
you can't make this up.
I know, but Jeffrey, how does a guy 6'8", the big bird at the White House, how does he hide in the drapes?
Exactly. Now, I can tell you, having been there, this is the blue room they're talking about, I believe.
Yes.
I mean, it's very tall. I mean, they get a mammoth Christmas tree every year and put it right there in the middle of the blue room. So these drapes are much taller than even Jim Comey. So, yeah, there would be, if that's what your objective is, you could walk over there and put these things around you. The question is, why would you do it? I just am astounded. He's the director of the FBI. And this whole business that he had this conversation with Trump after Trump asked the attorney general and the vice president to leave the room on another occasion and then said something to the effect, well, Flynn is a good guy, which is a nothing burger. I mean, he didn't direct him to do anything. If Comey felt that that was improper, when that conversation was done, the attorney general, I now found out, was right outside in the hallway. And all he had to do was go to the attorney general that minute and say, the president has just had an improper conversation with me, and I want to report it to you. He didn't do it. And there's a reason why. It wasn't improper.
Now, speaking of the attorney general, he's had to recuse himself in this Russian probe. So the deputy attorney general appointed a special prosecutor in the form of the former FBI director Mueller. What has been your reaction to it? Because the president wasn't all that favorably disposed towards it.
Well, I'm just not favorably disposed to special prosecutors. I believe in, you know, if they want to do this, have a commission with 9 Republicans, 9 Democrats, and a chairman and that sort of thing. Special prosecutors, as I have observed them, from Nixon all the way through Clinton, get off on tangents. And I know the Clinton people... and this is what I find so interesting, is all the uproar over Nixon firing Archibald Cox during the Watergate thing, the media and Democrats, elevated the concept of the special prosecutor to like a semi-god. And then along comes Ken Starr in the Clinton case, and all of a sudden the White House is going out there attacking the guy as a sleazeball, and, I mean, seriously attacking the guy and doing him damage. And... the special prosecutor was no more a semi-god. He was terrible. I think the lesson here, which is why this particular kind of special prosecutor outside the government was finally, the law was finally allowed to expire, is that they began to realize, you know, you don't give a lawyer unending funding and then let him go do anything he wants. And so I'm a little wary about that. But Mr. Mueller has a good reputation. We will see. But, I mean, at this point, after what, all this time, I want to know, no one yet has produced a shred of evidence of quote-unquote collusion. Even Senator Feinstein was on with Wolf Blitzer the other day. Nope, she doesn't have it either.
Well, I'll tell you this much, Jeffrey Lord, CNN political commentator, defender of Donald Trump. You have taught us that to order a steak and to order Heinz 57 ketchup with it is copacetic, at least when you're living outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and the heartland.
The Drive at 5. On the air, on the app. Curtis Sliwa, live.
My boy Curtis Sliwa.
Local.
There's a guy in a red hat.
On it.
Everybody listens to Curtis.
77 WABC.
As we continue on the drive home at 5. And for years, he was a fixture with the Queen of Talk Radio, Joan Hamburg, that you can actually listen to tomorrow, Saturdays 1 to 3, right here at WABC. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, and author of Arthur Schwartz, New York City Food. And we welcome him to the drive home at 5 for the very first time. Thanks for joining us, Arthur.
I'm thrilled, Curtis. I'm a big fan. Big, big fan.
Oh. Well, you're stroking me here.
And also, I grew up in the next neighborhood from you. You're from Canarsie. I'm from Marine Park.
Oh, yeah. So you're over at Marine Park, right? You were near the Gil Hodges Lane?
Except that it wasn't called that then. I'm older than you.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. It was the Marine Park Bridge when I was a kid.
That's right. Now it's Gil Hodges.
Now it's Gil Hodges, right.
All right.
Anyway.
So you said the geography, and I must ask you this, because the big story coming out of the trip that the president is taking to Saudi Arabia, he took off on Air Force One from Landover Air Force Base hours ago. was that the Saudi Arabian chefs have been told that at the very first meal, when Trump sits with the House of Fraud, you know, the 3,000 fake, phony, fraudulent princes with their fake mustaches, beards, and schmatas.
And schmatas, yeah.
Right, that they got to ready a halal steak and have Heinz 51 ketchup at the table. 57.
Let's not, you know, skip out on six of those ingredients, whatever they are.
So what's the... What's
you
the
know, right? This should be his worst flaw, okay? I have a cousin who only eats steak with ketchup, but as she says, I only eat it in private because, of course, she would be derided by everybody in the family and all her friends and if she ate it in public. So, I mean, he's the president, so I guess he can eat it in public.
But isn't that like an insult to the chef, you know, if you ask for ketchup with your steak?
With your steak, if it's a good steak, you know. If it's a bad steak, drown it in ketchup, as far as I'm concerned. And it's hard to get a good steak. That's the problem. I don't know what kind of taste system the president has, but you know, I doubt that it's good.
Now, let me flip
so
the script.
Probably for him, it doesn't matter what kind of steak it is, as long as it's not lamb.
Right, but let me flip the script, Arthur Schwartz, food maven, yes. Because we know this president is a fast food connoisseur, whether
right.
It's KFC, Mickey D's, he can't get enough of it. And I see that all of a sudden, Five Guys has been named the favorite burger chain.
Yeah, in but who named it?
Who named it?
Yeah, that's important to know. Who named it the best?
Well, a Harris poll, supposedly, according to users of hamburger chains, have decided it's better than Shake Shack, Wendy's, In-N-Out, you know, the other burger chains.
Yeah, I don't get it myself. I live in Brooklyn still, Curtis, and here in the north end of Brooklyn, there was three, Five Guys, is that what they're called?
Yeah, Five Guys.
And there's now only one. So Brooklyn has better taste than the rest of the country, apparently, since we closed down two of them. And the one that's still open is across the street from Methodist Hospital, which is now actually called, this is not a joke, it's Presbyterian Methodist Hospital. And, you know, I think that there's unsuspecting visitors to the hospital and maybe some bad-eating staff who keep it open. I don't know. I went twice. I was not impressed. I thought it was very pretentious. You know, they claimed, I don't know if they make this claim anymore, that their potatoes come from particular towns in Idaho and wherever else they're growing potatoes. So they have a sign up every day saying, the potatoes today come from this place. Believe it or not. They were good potatoes, actually, in the beginning. I haven't had one in years. And Shake Shack, I don't get it at all. I don't get it. I don't understand what's the big attraction of Shake Shack.
I tell you what Five Guys' attraction is because my two youngest sons, they love it. Is you get
they love Shake Shack.
No. They love Five Guys because you get free peanuts, endless free peanuts.
Ah, well, that's the thing.
So if you were Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, you could put...
I love that you call him Shamu, yeah.
You could put all those Five Guys out of business just by eating all those free peanuts.
That's right. And also, at the Five Guys... Listen, I was only interested in Five Guys. Think back. The first restaurant that Obama went to when he got into the White House was Five Guys. And it was a big story that the president snuck out of the White House and went to Five Guys. Well, the reason is it's a Washington-based chain, and they didn't have them in Chicago. So, and he heard all about it. So a lot of this is buzz. So I never heard what Obama thought of Five Guys, but I never heard of him going back. And I realized after a few years of his presidency, the guy is a food adventurer. He just wants to try everything, even though he's skinny and all that, you know, his genes more than, I think, his diet.
Yeah, but Arthur, you got to understand, if you've spent time in Chi-Town, they have what we have. They've got the Belly Busters. They've got the White Castles. So, yeah. You know, he goes, this is like five-star, top-shelf gourmet food for him. Five Guys compared to White Castle.
Why don't we say the most disheartening thing in my life, because I've been a restaurant critic for my whole adult life, is watching people enjoy bad food. And it happens every day. I see people enjoy bad food. Oh, speaking of a good fast food hamburger, however, Do you know that Wahlburgers just opened in Coney Island?
Yeah.
Right? Diagonally across the street from Nathan's. That's owned by Mark Wahlberger's brother, Paul. Well, I think the whole family has an interest in it. And I went, and it's good.
Ah, so instead of having dirty water hot dogs.
There.
Right, so instead of having dirty water hot dogs across to Nathan's and have to take a reverse mortgage because the prices are exorbitant, go to Wahlburgers, according to Arthur Schwartz, the food maven and author of Arthur Schwartz's New York City Food, residing right there in Brooklyn. Apparently grew up in Marine Park right next to me in Canarsie. And I didn't even have a chance to ask him about Cracker Barrel, where they spray fake country taste on all the food. Maybe the next time.
Deep connections, deep understanding.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
He's a man of the people.
77 WABC.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's the call to the races. And if you remember, 2 weeks ago, with the start of the Kentucky Derby, when many of you were half in the bag having your mint juleps, who was the one who picked the winner out of 20 horses, right? Right out of the gates. Now, I know it was a sloppy trap that day in Louisville, but I picked Always Dreaming with the great Johnny Velasquez riding him to victory out of the Bronx vis-a-vis Puerto Rico. And tomorrow is the second leg of the Triple Crown. So it's an opportunity to make yourself a lot more moolah shmoolah if all of a sudden you dissed and dismissed me the first time around. And then all of a sudden you were a sore loser, right? Well, how about being a winner? Because I'm picking Always Dreaming to win the second leg of the Triple Crown, the Preakness, tomorrow outside of Baltimore. But the odds are 3-5. So that what that means is if you bet on Always Dreaming to win, you bet $5, but you're only going to win $3. So why would you do that? You end up losing. No. What you got to do is you got to bet 4 separate exacta boxes. These are exotic bets. So you bet Always Dreaming either first or second. And then you tag it on with either Multiplier, Classic Empire, Senior Investment, or Looking at Leap so that you have 5 picks. And then if you bet there are 4 separate exacta boxes, you're going to be rolling in dough. So raid the kids' college education fund. Take out a reverse mortgage, you're going to win. And by the way, we may need those thoroughbreds to get around here in New York City because the MTA, the money control, the money taking agency that Jeff McKay is often quoting about when he gives you the traffic updates, is as bad now as any form of delays that he reports about on the LIRR part of the MTA or the New Jersey Transit or the Amtrak service down below us 17 floors. And in fact, it was earlier today that your mayor, not mine, comrade Bill de Blasio, was blaming the MTA's problems all on Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Bruto, King Cuomo I.
That's a fantasy. That's absolutely inaccurate. And he said earlier in the year he was in charge and he was focused. So let's be clear. You know, there's a division of labor. It's out in the open. Let's not kid around anymore. If you have a concern, if you like something NYPD is doing or you don't like it, talk to me. You like something going on in the schools or you don't like it, talk to me. If you like something happening in our subways or don't like it, talk to the governor. He's in charge. He should just own up to it and take this responsibility seriously and put forward a plan.
One of the few times I've actually ever agreed with Comrade de Blasio because, in fact, it is the governor's responsibility. Remember him when he cut the blue ribbon for the start of the special Q train service, the completion of the 3 stations on the 2nd Avenue line that we were waiting, Maquanamai, a month of Sundays to complete, $6 billion. It was called state-of-the-art. He actually was Choo-Choo Charlie, the engineer, in the very first cab driving that train, naturally with the assistance of an MTA conductor and engineer. But we've seen the escalators are not working at 86th Street. We see that elevators are not working there. And this is in the state-of-the-art, brand-new $6 billion link of the 2nd Avenue subway service. But earlier today, there were falling debris that caused service changes for the number 2 and 3 subways. And a separate incident involving signal problems is still causing delays all through this late rush hour, delays on the F, N, Q, R, and W line. And this weekend, many of you are going to be queuing up on platforms, and you're going to see trains running by you that have been completely rerouted. The E runs on the F line, but the F runs on the E line. Or there's no C service, or there's no B service, or there's no L service. And naturally, they're doing track repairs and tunnel repairs, and I understand that. And you have to take shuttle buses. But all those problems and the chaos that we see on the weekends, Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Bruta Cuomo, King Cuomo I, and the king of the MTA, money-taking agency, well, the chickens are all coming home to roost because the problems are now taking place Monday through Friday. That's right, through the rush hours and the off-peak hours. And where is Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo on the decay and the decrepit nature of the IRT, IND, BMT service? What is he saying? Oh, the MTA should run Penn Station? That's a double oofah to you, Cuomo.